Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Poetry Salon Cast. I'm your host, Tricia Faye Hefner.
And I'm Callie Grace Thomas.
On each episode, we interview one of our favorite poets to ask what got them started writing.
And what keeps them going.
And my favorite question, what do they do with a rough draft that wants to play rough?
Then we ask for advice that we and you, our listeners, can use in our own writing practices.
Without further ado, welcome to this week's episode of the Poetry Salon Cast.
Hello and welcome, Poetry Salon Cast listeners. I'm very excited because today on the podcast we have Sonia Greenfield, who is an amazing writer who I met out in Los Angeles right before she got seduced away from Los Angeles to Minneapolis, where she lives now. Her latest book is Let Down, which was just released by White Pine Press. Thank you so much, Sonia, for being here. I want to invite you to start us off by just reading two poems and no commentary needed. Just read the poems and then we'll discuss them at length later.
Okay. The first poem I'm going to read is the very first poem in my very first collection of poetry. And it's called Milk Carton Kids. Now you know they were abducted on the way to school, past chain link urban puzzles, robins scrabbling in the median, book bags hanging with the weight of history, or off the side of a rural road in late spring, where slapped mosquitoes left smears of horse blood, and the churn of a distant John Deere sounded like the log sawing of sleep. Were the teens taken under the lantern of the supermoon by the unused railroad tracks where flowering quince unfolds pale pink among the blackberry brambles and wharf rats run the length of cool steel in search of dropped chips? Or in the desert when dusk slips on her silk nightie and the saucers scream like gulls while the aliens shape their ecto like cacti, go green and prickly. The extraterrestrials tap their feet to snap on high beams, but we call them stars. Up the kids go as your radio loses its tune, the television becomes a box of static, and the digital clock blinks five again and again, not stuffed in a trunk, not dragged from a lake.
Gorgeous.
And then the second poem I'll read is called Ghost Ship. And this one is in the chapbook American Parable, which is available through Autumn House Press. Ghost Ship. Oh, and just to preface this to say that this is in reference to the ghost ship fire that happened in the Bay Area several years ago, and a lot of young people died in that fire. And I lived in the Bay Area for 10 years in the mid-90s through to the mid-aughts. So this poem makes reference to that. Ghost Ship. I have been that young, that electrified by the bohemian scene of a city spilling its lights all around me. I have been to parties and sketchy spaces where painters have work on the walls that should be seen by millions, but is seen by the few of us figuring out who we're going to fuck after too much cheap wine drunk from plastic tumblers and figuring out how we're going to make it a country's width away from families, struck out on our own like explorers getting comfortable with being alone in a wilderness that is actually just a room rented in a house of strangers. I have been that woman high on E, my eyes dull dark, jaw clenched, body ready to swallow pleasure in a million lusty gulps. I know any space we inhabit can become a ghost ship. I have read enough to know stories of wildfires, of boats found empty, of the soul yanked whole cloth from its innocent wearer. But you can't live in fear of the apparition, the adventurers afloat on their rickety structure and cast to a sea of flames. It can happen at any time to anyone. So when music flares up and takes hold of you, when a swirl of colored spotlights sets you spinning, you have to dance as if the very act of living depends on it.
Beautiful. What a last line.
Sonia, I so enjoy your work. It's just so vibrant, having lived in the Bay Area myself. And now, Kelly, that's where you live, too. I mean, it really, it just really connects that whole bohemian atmosphere. And of course, you know, I didn't have any friends who died in the ghost ship fire, but I had friends of friends who died in the ghost ship fire. Any one of those people are probably people I could have run into at some other party at some other time. So it definitely resonates, that poem particularly resonates with me. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, when I lived in the Bay Area, as the poem suggests, I was very much in that, like, the melodrama of youth. So I was always at parties. I was always raving with glow sticks and figuring out who my lover was going to be next, which gender they were going to be. And it was like 90s San Francisco. It's great.
Yeah, that's a perfect segue into my next question, which is, tell us about your youth. Tell us about where poetry entered, how you started getting into the writing.
Sure. I guess I muddled around with it as a teenager. I'm sorry that I've lost these papers that I had of just these most cheesy rhyming poems that were so dramatic and about suicide and treachery, and they're all gone. They're cast to a sea of flames, right? I was 22 when I started college and started taking some writing classes. And then I moved to San Francisco in 94. I was starting as a double major. I was really interested in getting into the animal sciences. Wasn't sure if it was going to be zoology or marine biology. And 2 weeks into the semester, I dropped the bio classes and took a couple more writing classes, because at that point I was really under the spell of creating. And so from there, I've got my bachelor's in English with a concentration in creative writing, and I didn't know what I was going to do next. I was like either working in a bookstore, working at Trader Joe's, or producing television about video games. Like, those were the things that I did in San Francisco, and I can't quite align them in the timeline. But then when I was at San Francisco State, I graduated and I was like, well, I'm just going to keep going. So then I went and got my MA at San Francisco State University. And then at that point, we all know that the MFA is next, right? And so then I got into the MFA program at the University of Washington. And I got to study with Rick Kenny and Linda Beards and Heather McHugh and Colleen McElroy. It was a really great experience. And the only thing I regret is my sort of lack of scholarship, because I was still trying to figure out who my lovers were going to be, right? And that's where I also met my husband, when I was in the summer between my first and second year of my MFA. I also met substantial part of my inner circle of my tribe in my MFA program, who are still, I'm still really close to today, and who in fact sent that bouquet to me for my 50th birthday. So that's how I came to poetry. And I dabble in other genre writing in other genres too, but it's still how I try to make sense of the world.
Happy birthday, by the way. That's awesome. I hope that it was a merry one. I love your exploration of how you became you in terms of an artist and an explorer and identity and a poet. And I'm wondering, you said you kind of dabble in other genres. What was it about poetry in specific that hooked you, that said, like, this is my first primary love language?
It's really interesting. I've been thinking lately about the idea that throughout a good part of my life, I've probably been undiagnosed with attention deficit disorder. So the idea of sustaining a long narrative is not something that I can stick with. But within a small box, I can focus on what I like about poetry is that it requires extreme precision. And, you know, obviously really excellent prose writers also write with a precision, but it has to go on for so much longer to tell their narrative. I feel like with poetry, I can be very exacting. And so I can concentrate really hard on something, but I don't have to do it for a year on the same project. And even like when you think about a collection of poetry, it's something that you accumulate. And I know there are poets who write toward a project. And even with my latest book, Letdown, which does have a narrative arc, it was still a process of accumulation of the pieces being written individually and then figuring out how that puzzle fits together. Even when I do work in the genre of fiction, it's always like short pieces, right? Because the idea of a long sustained narrative is beyond my mental capacity. What I like about it is the precision of working with the unit of the sentence and making really exacting sentences. So I guess that's what I sort of feel like why poetry works for me.
Awesome. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about Letdown. I've heard you describe it as a book about your son, about age-related infertility, about joy, about so many different things. And it sounds like there's a lot of contrasting and intersecting themes. So I would love to hear how those themes come to play, especially through the narrative arc that you mentioned before.
Sure. You know, life is made up of moments, right? And so the book is isolated moments. So it's through a process of accretion that the narrative arc is built, but each piece was just me trying to work out the shit I was going through. And so some of the pieces are about my son's autism diagnosis, and some of the pieces are about his epilepsy diagnosis. And some of the pieces are about the miscarriages I had, and some of the pieces are about the attempt and failure to have a second child. But even within all of those moments that I was experiencing in this span of time, there were still a lot of joyous moments because that's how life happens. I could have had a miscarriage the day before and then the day after that, take my son to a carnival and have it be lights and joy and laughter and stick in my mind as this Technicolor Los Angeles scene to me. There's a line in one of the poems about the idea of being, here it is. I admit it is hard to see fortune meted out by blindfolded gods, hard to feel blindsided by uneven blessings, and that the book is really about uneven blessings. You know, maybe there are people out there in the world who do get everything they've ever wanted in life, and I say to them, fuck you. But but the rest of us, you know, we're fine-tuning our gratitude and practicing it like a yogi.
Sonia, I love that idea of, you know, the uneven blessings. I'm wondering, I feel that poets tend to write when we're challenged by something. Patricia Smith says if she's happy, she's out at dinner, she's not writing poetry, you know? And I feel like in poetry, hey, I could be having the best day in the world, but you give me a writing prompt and within 5 minutes, I'm probably thinking about the last time I was sad or the one time that I most recently had a fight with my father. Are you more inclined to write about the miscarriage than the day at the carnival the next day? Or how does that work for you?
I was thinking the other day about the sort of films and literature that really get to us. And it's always because they overlap things that seem to be at odds with each other. If a film is funny and touching, it's better than a film that's either funny or touching. And so I think about poems that are good are poems that address loss and reflect a sense of gratitude, or poems that are tragic and exquisitely beautiful in their rendering, and that those are the things that really stick with us. And so when I think about gratitude, I think about it is most keenly felt when you have experienced loss. And, you know, it's probably unfair to say that people who haven't experienced loss say, well, you know, I'm filled with gratitude. Is your gratitude as keen as it is for somebody who understands what they have through the lens of what they don't have, or what they had but don't have anymore? Poems that are like joyous and sad at the same time, those are the ones that we gravitate towards.
Yeah, I think that's really very interesting. And it's kind of like the willingness that you have to be vulnerable is equal to your ability then to be strong. And I feel like that's what poetry is. You know, Rumi's poem, The Guest House, this being human is a guest house. Every day, some new emotion arrives and you must treat them all honorably because they might be clearing you out for some new delight. That's part of what we do as poets, is really live all of the feelings as deeply as possible and not turn away from them.
Well, and just what you were saying earlier about when you might be having a great day, but then you go and you sort of write about something that's stuck in your craw, some issue you're maybe still trying to work out, and that's why you're going to poetry. The poems that we write that are, you know, the sad poems, then we put them out there in the world, and somebody else who's sad reads that poem is like, oh, I'm sad about that too. And look, here's this other person who's sad about this thing. And now look, we're not alone. We're in this together. We're part of the sad club. And now I feel less sad because I have somebody who's written about it.
Yeah, I always say that I think poetry keeps the best company. I mean, to challenge myself and to understand myself and to understand the world, but I think a lot of times that I'm seeking companionship or solace, you know, misery loves company, but so does joy and so does gratitude. I have a question about the balance of the joy and the sorrow. I know that Maya Angelou said, whenever there's a dark thing, we have to engineer these moments of light. So it reflects life. Like you said, we have the push and the pull and the good and the bad. I'm wondering from just a craft perspective, if that is something that's innate in you or if that's something that has been learned over time.
Let me think. From a craft perspective, I'm not consciously thinking about weaving those two things. But one of the things I do know about my poems is that I am so often making poems that rewrite history, to take a narrative, say, from like the poem that I read, Milk Cart from Kids, which is basically like, I don't like the real world. I'm going to write a poem that points out this thing we all know is true from the real world, but then I'm going to rewrite that story and give this poem to you so that you can feel like there's a parallel world filled with magic and that magic heals things. In terms of the craft concept, sometimes when I'm starting a poem, I know exactly where it's going to land. And then sometimes I'll start it in one place and it'll take me someplace else. But I'm not usually consciously thinking like, okay, I have to weave the red ribbon of joy through this bird's nest or anything like that.
Yeah, I just wondered because for me, I have to think, okay, it can't all be storm clouds. I think there needs to be a balance for it to feel human.
Well, sure. And I remember reading something, it was an essay maybe by Stephen Dunn. This is a long time ago in grad school, The Good Poem and the Not So Good Poem. And he said something along the lines of, even the saddest poems should have some sort of play. And he was talking about the play of craft. Like craft allows us to find joy in the way we're using language. Mm. And that those are the poems are ones that we really gravitate towards. But also, I think within the context of a single poem, just let that poem be hella sad, right? But then the next poem maybe goes someplace else.
That's so interesting. There's a quote I love by Galway Tinnell where he says, even singing a sad song requires an absolute happiness. You know, even writing a sad poem requires an absolute happiness. Why? Because you're taking possession of it. You're taking control of it. You're beautifying it with language or finding the thing that calls people into it. Or even maybe just the fact that you're able, you're allowed, you're alive and you're able to write and you're able to express yourself. So that's sort of what poetry allows us to do and allows us to make happiness even out of the worst, saddest poems still make you happy to read them.
Yeah, well, I think that there's a certain requirement of partitioning the emotional hurt self from the cold mind of the craftsperson. And that might be a strange way to put it. You know, I think about Sylvia Plath and everybody sort of talking about her as this wildly depressed, mad woman who committed suicide. But when she was sitting down to work on her poems, she was clearly partitioning her life from the craftsperson she was being. Sometimes we need to be able to put a month or two or three between us and what it is that we want to write about.
So I want to ask a little bit about your relationship with formal education, because you said that you went to your undergraduate program, you know, in your early 20s, and I know that you have an MFA now. So
I have three masters.
That's awesome.
I know about the MFA. I don't know about these other two. So now I'm even more intrigued. Can you talk a little bit about how that's affected your writing? And can you also tell me what are the other two master's degrees in?
Yeah, well, I told you about the first one from San Francisco State, which was just a master's in English with an emphasis in creative writing. And then I got the MFA at the University of Washington. And then I got a master's of professional writing from USC. One of the things that is true when we're in grad school is that we're also working with our peers, helping them to crystallize their own voices. And by doing that, we're also better understanding our voices in contrast to or in the context of their voices. And so I think that that's another way that grad school helped me, is it helped me figure out what my peers were trying to do. And in doing so, helped me better understand what it was that I wanted to do. It teaches discipline. Certainly my last master's taught me some discipline. It introduces you to writing you would not have been aware of otherwise. So what you have when you go into a graduate program are scholars ahead of you, a generation ahead of you potentially, if not in age, then in scholarship. And introduce you to texts and how to read them deeply and carefully. I feel like our poetry is a result of a internalized conglomeration of voices in the writers who have influenced us. You know, obviously it's too problematic if you internalize Ann Carson and then regurgitate Ann Carson in your own writing in such a way that people are like, wow, this person totally cribbed Ann Carson. That would be bad. But we do internalize all the different voices that have influenced us. And so one of the great things of going to grad school for me was my internalized library is bigger now and is more diverse.
We are, absolutely. I think we're a conglomerate of voices. I would think that you have also learned and heard a lot as a literary organizer. I think of you as a really great literary citizen with the Southern Poetry Festival. Southern Poetry Festival? Is that correct?
Southern California Poetry Festival.
Southern California, yeah. Not all
the South. What did I call it? Called the SoCal PoFest. That's what I called it. Yeah. That was a really good thing for me to do because I had gotten some money and from an organization to help organize that. And that was me wanting to contribute. And then also editing the Rise Up Review was, again, I really feel like if one wants to be part of a community, one has to be a contributor to that community in some way. You can't ask the community to only give to you. You have to be a participating member, right?
I'm wondering about the Rise Up Review. Can you just talk a little bit about it?
Well, Trump was elected president and I was fucking pissed. So I know we needed an outlet for other angry folks, a protest journal, a journal for resistance. I think I launched it on Inauguration Day, probably. And to be honest, I'm sort of hoping, because it's a lot of work to create a journal and run a journal, I'm sort of hoping that Trump is elected out of office and the project that was the Rise Up Review can be not retired, but put in a time capsule.
Yes. Preserved. I think of it as a flash of what the world was, had become, and will be again, hopefully in terms of things that restore our hope, but also propel conversations. I am a big believer of things happening for a reason. It was so funny. We were talking about this. I had a EDI conversation at my work, and I had a friend, a Black friend, Monique Mitchell, who's also a very fabulous poet and community organizer. And I remember crying when Trump got elected and coming in the next day and Monique saying, I'm happy. Like, now it's so overt how racist this country is. As negative and horrible and hate-inducing as Trump has been and as politics tend to be at times, I think it's a refreshing to get these things out in the open so some kind of progress or movement can be made.
Sure. He's been a galvanizing figure, and that the only way for meaningful progress to happen is through meaningful and purposeful action. And so I think that organizing has been truly stepped up because he became president. And so I'm really hoping that meaningful change will come from these past unfortunate three and a half, four years. So
the Poetry Salon is on a mission to provide inspiration, education, and support to poets everywhere at a price that is truly affordable for all.
Together, we are building a thriving community where poets can learn, grow, and share their work.
Whether you are a beginning poet or already a published author, you can get prompts, rewrite strategies, and a warm, supportive place where you can share your writing with other poets online.
Visit thepoetrysalon.com to find out more and register today.
Yeah, okay, so now is probably a good time to segue into talking about craft and process. I would really like to know more about the genesis of those two poems you read. Which one of them came easy? Which one of them was challenging?
Yeah, absolutely. So the poem Milk Carton Kids, the first one that I read, was a Frankenstein poem. Parts of it had been surgically removed from this terrible vampire poem I was trying to write. It was so awful. Like, you have, sometimes we get this idea in our head, wouldn't it be cool if I could write this thing if I had the skill to write it? And then you try to write it and you're like, don't have that skill yet. Nope. Yes. We'll throw that one out. But I took a section of it out because I thought that the images were good, right? And so I extracted that dead organ or whatever from that Frankenstein from that poem. I also had this failed poem about the X-Files, and I took a part of that poem out and then threw the rest of that poem away. And so then I had these couple of sections of it I thought were like good images. And this all was sort of happening when there was some missing child case in the news that ended tragically. And then I was like, God damn it, I wish things were different. I wish there was a different narrative. And that's how this poem happened. But it wasn't a poem that was like written from top to bottom. It was a poem that was Frankenstein together. And then once I started doing that, then I was like, oh, now I see what I need. I need a a beginning and an end. So that was the one I would say was probably the harder poem.
Can I just pause you to ask a little bit more about wishing something could be different in the world? Did you immediately connect that to your poem, or how did that inform what you did with your poem next?
I think, like I said later, a lot of my poems are wishful thinking poems, or poems that rewrite history, or poems that reconceive of something terrible in a way that makes it less terrible. When I started the poem, I was like, you know what? No, these kids, terrible things haven't been happened to them. They've just been like taken up into the sky by UFOs, nice aliens or something. Just this concept of maybe they're not dead, maybe they're alive somewhere. Poetry and narratives in general offer the opportunity to take you outside of reality.
Again, that balance of sorrow and joy, right? That we have to take something and spin it into something that is a grander wish or idea or solution.
Yeah, thank you. But go on, tell us about the next one, or if you had something else to add about the milk carton.
No, that poem, I just liked the moving through landscapes. That was really enjoyable to me to sort of bring together this concept of it happening all over the place and moving from landscape to landscape was fun. And then in the end, reminding me of the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. There was some imagery in the poem that was not borrowed from, but it giving a nod to that movie. So the other poem, you know, sometimes you sit down to write a poem and you just go, all right, I'm going to start at the beginning and I'm just going to write and it's going to end. And then you're just going to write the whole thing through and it's going to come out as if it had been wound like a thread in your head and you just grab the end of it and you just pull it out, right? And that's how Ghost Ship happened. It was like the whole thing was already conceived of and woven on the internal loom of your, of my, not the loom, what do you call the thing that you make yarn from?
The spool.
I don't know about yarn.
That Sleeping Beauty pricked her finger on.
Spindle.
Yeah, like so the weaving loom, whatever you call it. Anyway, it's like I got one of those in my head and in my head, this whole poem had been built and then I just grabbed the end of it and like pulled it out of my nose. And then the whole poem just came out all the way conceived. That's really gratifying. Again, this poem is basically about, it could have been me. I could have been in that where, and so much of fate is the concept of being in the wrong place at the wrong time or the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was trying to explore with the poem, which is basically like, look, wrong place, wrong time, right place, right time. You can't fret about it your whole life. You just have to find as much joy as possible and live your life as fullest as you can, for someday you shall die, you know, I guess is what the poem was reflecting on.
Yeah, I thought about that too. I mean, that one, there's a very clear personal connection. There's like this built-in tension. That could have been me. I could have been there. And of course, because you have the experience of living in the Bay Area and going to those parties, like all the imagery, I'm sure, is already kind of built in there for you. Mm-hmm. Whereas with, you know, the milk carton poem, it is calling on the imagination. You've got to invent the things that aren't there, which I know for some people, I think that's actually easier for them. Whereas some of us are more the observers of the reality that is there.
Yeah, it is really fun to be able to inject fiction into poetry. It's always obvious when it's fictive, right? At least it is in my poetry, because there's a lot of magical realism and stuff like that. But, you know, it is really fun to be able to sort of step away from trudging through my own reality. Because, you know, I get sick of my own shit. And that's why I need to go to these other places with my poetry. Like, I don't want to write another sad poem about me. You know, let me make something up.
I had the same thing, Sonia, that I was like, I also, you know, having issues around infertility, and we're writing these really heavy poems, and I was just like, I can't take another, like, I cannot. So I started writing these weird animal fact poems. Mm. And the agreement with myself was I could not use the word I, like, nothing about it could connect to me. And I just wanted to think about these animals and, you know, the magicalness of them and the weird quirky things that they do. And I think that there's a lot of relief in that. And I think as readers, there's a lot of relief too, that we're like, cool, let's go explore and make believe. And I don't know if poets, at least young poets, are reminded of that enough.
You know, Kelly, it's always so funny because I feel like, you know, you are one of the most positive people I know. And literally, if someone were to ask, what does Kelly do for a living? And be like, she turns shit to gold. Just give her shit and she turns it into gold. That's what she does. She's just a positivity machine. Sometimes I think poetry can be a way to just get to what we're not talking about and doing in our day-to-day lives. And sometimes it's a great way to express what is going on in our day-to-day lives. But it's a tool. It can be used as both looking at what is really there and then throwing all that aside and saying, I don't like that anymore. Let's envision something better. I actually wanted to ask you about something else, Sonia, with your work with Rise Up Review. And also, I think this circles back to your having been in graduate school and getting exposed to more people you maybe didn't get exposed to. One of the things that I realize, having come from Los Angeles, is it's been harder for me to be exposed to a diversity of voices. I think in my personal life, you know, there's the poets that everyone is reading now, but I don't know about a lot of the up and coming poets. And I'm wondering if you have some recommendations for us and for those listening about who we might not otherwise be getting exposed to, but that who we should be paying attention to.
That's a good question. You know, it's funny, being the editor of the Rise Up Review, I still get so much work by well-meaning white ladies. I think about myself as like a well-meaning white lady. And like most of the poems that I receive are from well-meaning white ladies. And it's sometimes a struggle as a young journal to inject the kind of diversity one would like into your journal. And so, you know, you try some soliciting for submissions and going directly to people, and sometimes you never hear back, or you're less aware of newer voices than you would like to be. But let's see, I know that Torin Greathouse, who's a trans woman from Orange County, just won one of the most recent Milkweed prizes. So that'll probably be coming out next year. And I think that that's definitely a book to watch for. Mm. I feel like I should go over to my bookshelf.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, and you know, there are some poets that people may not know about to think about, like Etheridge Knight, who's a Black poet, wrote quite a while ago, writing around the same time as James Baldwin was, maybe. And a lot of people don't know his work, but it's really pretty dynamic, and it would be a good one to do some reading of.
And if you're familiar, beautiful poem by Etheridge Knight, I recommend Belly Song. There's a line that, like, the sea inside of me sings to the sea inside of you, and together it is like this meditation of love and rocking and meeting, and it's really great. While Sonia's looking, I will just say for our readers, there's an anthology called The Best New Poets that comes out every year. That is a great place to look for new poets and diverse poets. Boat Journal is a great place. Muzzle, Adroy, The Rumpus. So all of these places I see, really, The Offing is wonderful in terms of new diverse voices. And more, I would say, like, more older, established, I think of traditional academic printed journals versus online, newer, led by they might not consider themselves youth, but some of them are 24, 25, you know, fairly young for the poetry space.
Yeah. And Kelly, you're, of course, such a great resource for that, because, like, you got your pulse on what the young people are doing now.
Exactly. And
No, I was just going to say, and another good one that just pops into mind, too, is button poetry, which is more for performance poems and poets. Mm-hmm. But I love them. And you can, you know, contribute to them on Patreon and get some of their videos in advance. Sonia.
So I'm going to recommend one particular book of poetry by a Long Beach poet, and it is Dear Sincerely by David Hernandez. The level of gravitas and play in his poems is so well done. They're moving, they're clever, they're accessible. They deal with topics of social justice. I just feel like he's really one of those poets that people should be reading. Let's see, I read Fatima Oscar's If They Come For Us, and that was a really great collection of poetry. And Hanif Abdurraqib's book, They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us, which is a collection of essays that sort of interweave music, writing, and social justice. And I thought that was a really super engaging book. Those are some writers that I think people should maybe know about.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much. And thank you for all that you're doing with Rise Up Review. I think it's just great to be creating a space where people can talk through poetry about what's going on right now. And thank you for those recommendations. And I really, really hope people go out and buy your book, which is Let Down from White Pine Press, as well as the books that you recommended. Dear Sincerely by
David Hernandez.
Dear Sincerely by David Hernandez. And
If They Come For Us by Fatima Asghar, and They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us. I'm not sure if I think that's the right title, and that's by Hanif Abdurraqib.
All right. Thank you again, Sonia, for taking the time to let us pick your brain, and thank you for sharing your wisdom with us. It is just always a pleasure, and I hope when the world opens up again, I'll get to go out and see you in Minnesota during the summer sometime.
Me too.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much, Sonia. Always such a pleasure to talk to you and hear your work.
Thank you, my friends. Okay, take care of yourselves.
Hey, Saloncast listeners. Do you have questions you want us to ask our guests about the writing or rewriting process? Have you tried some of these rewriting strategies yourself? What new revelations did they bring?
Message us at Tricia@thepoetrysalon.com or Kelly@thepoetrysalon.com with the subject line Saloncast Listener.
Also, do you want to do a random act of kindness? How about a senseless act of beauty? Rate and review us and write a comment on this episode.
It truly helps us get heard and get seen, and it helps other poets find us in the chaotic distractions of cyberspace.
It takes less than a minute, and it's totally free.
Thanks again for being part of our community.
And remember to write on, share on.
And remember, whoever writes the worst draft wins.
Yay!